This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
From our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
In the months before the coronavirus crisis caused the entire world to hit the pause button, there were several major issues plaguing the nations. Our February Trumpet edition, February 2020, was headlined The Age of Protest. It talked about popular uprisings taking place in several states around the world. All of these were put on hold. Other issues like Iran's belligerent behavior, the migrant crisis from the Middle East into Europe, we haven't heard much about these for the last couple of months. But there are signs that as the nations begin to make their way toward the downslope of the coronavirus curve, those problems are beginning to crank back into action. We'll see this in several stories on today's program, as well as a couple of problems that the coronavirus itself is causing. But we'll start in China. We've discussed in recent episodes how it has used the preoccupation with coronavirus to quietly resume its efforts to take over the South China Sea. Now we're seeing China conducting illegal nuclear tests. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yes, there was a State Department report that was published on Wednesday saying that the evidence indicates that China has been setting off a whole series of what are called zero-yield nuclear explosions. So zero-yield tests are, it probably means that China is either testing tactical nuclear weapons, which are very small ones that can, you know, target with great precision, or it means that they're testing triggers for larger bombs. But in either case, zero-yield tests do not ignite the explosive chain reaction that we see with most nuclear warheads. So that means that they're far easier for a nation to conceal from monitoring agencies, especially when they are conducted underground. And that is that looks to be the case with these Chinese tests. The evidence points to them having occurred at China's Lopnur nuclear test site throughout last year and possibly into this year too. And part of the reason why this is so unsettling is because China has signed an agreement specifically banning this type of nuclear weapons test. And it has, you know, just repeatedly maintained and reiterated that it, you know, rigorously adheres to this agreement. So they did their very best to hide this from the world, including even disabling sensors on Chinese territory that alert monitoring groups of things like radioactive emissions releases into the atmosphere and also seismic activity. But we see now that despite what China says about adhering to this agreement, and despite their efforts to hide it, they are conducting these illegal zero-yield tests, and it's a really worrying development.
So you have a case here where China has said that it is going to comply with these measures to restrict these kinds of tests, and yet they're undertaking them behind the scenes. But then there have been other cases where China has actually said, no, we're not interested in complying at all, and they've been very open and upfront about it.
Well, you know, there are efforts underway right now for the United States and Russia to sign a kind of an equivalent to the START treaty, which is set to expire in February, I believe it is. And President Trump has very vocally and on many occasions tried to bring China into whatever the new equivalent to the START treaty will be. But China has repeatedly refused to. And they say, look, our nuclear arsenal is only about 290 weapons. It's not like the U.S. and Russia that have, you know, what is it, 13, 14,000 right now. And ours are strictly for defensive purposes. So they're not a threat to the global peace the way Russia's and the U.S.'s are. So they've refused to sign that. And other nuclear pacts as well. But I do think it's interesting that with the zero yield tests, they did sign on to that, and they, you know, told other nations to sign on, try to present themselves as an example. But here we see that despite their being a signatory to that, they're just flouting it.
And there actually have been some similar activities on the part of neighboring nations around China as well, haven't there?
Well, yes. I think that when you look at the timing of this, you know, right now, much of the world is fearful because of the this pandemic that China has unleashed on the world. And you might hope that this would be kind of a time for some reflection, possibly even some solidarity among the nations. But instead, some of the revisionist nations, some of those that are most determined to change the current global order, are using this time of fear and confusion kind of as cover to keep on pushing against their enemies and to keep on showcasing their military might. China, of course, is the big one here. We not only have these nuclear tests that they're illegally and unapologetically conducting, but then we've also seen China push in the South China Sea against rival claimants. As you mentioned a moment ago, we talked on the show last week about how they just sunk a Vietnamese fishing boat in Vietnamese waters earlier this month. This week, we're seeing exactly the same sort of thing happening in Malaysian waters, China versus some Malaysian fishing boats, where the Chinese are just trespassing and then harassing the Malaysians. We also see this in Taiwan's waters and airspace. But China's not alone. As you said, some of their nations are also pushing ahead with all kinds of, you know, belligerent displays of power. With Russia, we spoke on the show last month about these exercises in Crimea that they were carrying out, just showing the world that while everyone else was scrambling to deal with the coronavirus, the Russians are still ready for war. And then this week, the Russians tested a ground-based satellite killer. So this is, it's designed to show the U.S. especially that Russia could blind some of those satellite-based systems that our military and aspects of our industry rely on so much. And then China's other neighbor, North Korea, looks to be following the direction and possibly even the orders of Russia and China as well. They've been firing all kinds of short-range missiles off of their coasts. They've actually conducted 5 different missile tests in the last few weeks. So a huge increase from the lull that we saw for most of 2019 and the second half, I guess, of 2018 as well. So it's an unsettling time for many people around the world. And then you have these Asian belligerents just rattling their sabers more loudly than ever as it's all going on. So it's really, I think, a sad trend that's emerging there.
And how much do you see that the alignment between the timing of all of these nations locking down and Russia, China, North Korea actually taking advantage of this moment to press their agendas?
You know, it would not surprise me at all, especially the fact that North Korea is firing more and more missiles. We know that North Korea would not exist were it not for China's support and Russia's to a lesser degree. But North Korea, we could very much view as, you know, China uses it strategically to be a distraction at times so that the world is more concerned about North Korea's belligerence than China's belligerence. The North Koreans are very much beholden to China. So I think the fact that we see this uptick in North Korean missile tests shows that it probably is a coordinated effort by Russia, China, and their proxy nation, essentially, there, North Korea, to just stir up a little more chaos to add to what's already happening. It would be difficult to substantiate that, but to me it looks fairly obvious.
Nuclear weapons, you mentioned these tests by China being the tactical variety or triggers for larger nuclear weapons. And we don't tend to see nuclear arsenals in the headlines all that often, but the fact is that there are a lot of Bible prophecies that show that we really do need to be concerned about the fact that these types of weapons will actually be used.
That's exactly right. You know, there's a lot of chatter right now about whether the U.S. will be able to get China to sign on to a nuclear arms control pact or not. But the truth is, if you look into the Bible, you know that whether China signs such a deal or not, its nuclear stockpiles will soon be used in a global nuclear war, a war that the scriptures make plain will make all wars in history look in comparison like you know, a skirmish on a playground, basically. In Matthew 24, Jesus Christ himself warned about this age of nuclear proliferation that we are now living in. And he said nuclear war will break out, and it'll be so violent that it could kill every single person on earth. That's in verses 21 and 22 of Matthew 24. And that has to be describing the modern age of nuclear weapons that we are living in now, because in earlier eras of history, a conflict that could threaten to kill every single person just wasn't technologically possible. They didn't have the weapons that could do it. But today, with several nations, nine now that we know of that have nuclear weapons, and with nations like China just flouting international laws concerning these arms, right now the conditions are in place for this prophecy to be fulfilled.
Well, Jeremiah has written an article that should be going up on thetrumpet.com very soon. China conducts illegal nuclear arms tests. You can watch for that. And we'll also put a link to our booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, in the show notes for today's program, the booklet written by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, about the prophecies regarding nuclear warfare. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. Now to Iran. If you remember, the last couple of years, Iran was making several very provocative and aggressive moves against the United States and other nations. That was really what led to Donald Trump and his administration ordering the killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani at the beginning of January. That quieted down Iran for a while. But this week, Iran was back to its old tricks. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
On Wednesday, you might have seen the video of this actually, but on Wednesday, 11 fast attack boats, these are speedboats basically that have some mounted weapons on the front of them, they intercepted and harassed a couple of U.S. Navy vessels in the Persian Gulf. They were darting in between the vessels, going in front of the bow and the stern for about an hour. And some of the footage is quite surreal because they get so close to the Americans, and one of the American sailors is filming this. And you've got this guy with an unclipped gun, with a mounted gun on the front of the boat going driving right past the American boat, looking over at the Americans, waving his finger at the Americans in just some really in a provocative manner. And with his gun locked and loaded, ready to go, and the U.S. and the American servicemen actually drew attention to that. They could see that from the boat. And what's interesting about this is we haven't really seen this, let's say, in the past 2 years. This is something that Iran has done a lot of going back for the past couple of decades, really just harassing U.S. forces, British forces, inside the Persian Gulf, taking hostages from British and American ships in the past. Back in 2016, they did this. Back in, I think, 2007 or 8, they did that with the Brits. And so, you know, here we have the Iranians. They are up to their old tricks. And you have to think about, you know, the timing of this offensive harassment of U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, something that we haven't seen, let's say, in the past 2 years.
Why do you suppose the renewal of this type of activity?
Well, it probably has a couple of reasons. Iran is suffering right now like no other nation in the Middle East from corona. It actually is quite deadly there. And they're suffering from the financial sanctions, as we've talked about. And perhaps they are trying to show a bit of steel and resolve against the United States. And so this does actually placate a lot of the internal struggles if they can show themselves still standing up to the United States. Of course, their state media says that the United States wasn't in international waters. The United States was actually offensively coming into our waters and we fended them off. And so that might be one part of it. It also might be that the United States, that Iran does feel more emboldened, let's say over the past 2 or 3 months, because they have continually poked at America. And they haven't done anything. The U.S. hasn't responded. The U.S., you know, two servicemen, U.S. servicemen died last month from an Iranian-backed militia attack in Iraq that caused the United States to vacate six of their bases in Iraq and consolidate in bases in northern Iraq and Baghdad. And no real retaliation against Iran. And so it makes sense then that Iran would again try its hand in the Persian Gulf, remind the United States that we're still here and we're watching you. Of course, the United States Navy could destroy the Iranian Navy in maybe 3 or 4 days, but it would take some serious resolve and some action of the United States to do that. It's hard, actually, to attack these fast attack boats, which Iran has lots of them, and their whole defense of part of their defense of the Persian Gulf is predicated upon these fast attack boats. And so it would be decisive action, and it would involve a lot of resources to actually attack Iran and to defend themselves in the Persian Gulf if the United States did that. And so it makes sense for them to continue to push and to see what the United States will do. Iran's goal over the past decade and a half has been to remove the United States presence from the Middle East. And it feels like if it keeps poking at the US, that President Trump might decide to withdraw. He might also decide to attack them, but they're banking that with the timing of the election coming up, that they can probably get away with a fair bit before the United States would react.
Mm-hmm. You use the word push, and you can't see this type of activity without thinking of that prophecy in Daniel 11 that specifically describes the king of the south pushing, and this type of policy you see from Iran in a way that you really don't see from any other nation. Maybe you could just put this in the context of not only Iran's foreign policy generally, but why it's so concerned about this particular water.
So obviously a lot of Iran's oil comes out of the Persian Gulf, and this is their main lifeline to other international markets to get funding for their economy. But it's also one of the main exit points for a lot of Saudi Arabian oil, a lot of Emirati oil, a lot of oil from Bahrain, a lot of gas from Bahrain as well. And so this is a critical oil choke point that Iran wants to control. And if it is to go ahead and push at the rest of the world, as that prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40 says, one way that it could really do that would be to choke off or control or limit the transit of oil and other gas products through here. And they are interested in doing that, and they have tried to do that before, but they're not just interested in this one choke point through the Straits of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf. They're also interested in controlling the other choke point over on the other side of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, the Bab al-Mandab, which is why they are supporting the Houthi rebellion there. And they can mine that. They have mined that several times in the past few years, actually. And they've loaded the coastlines of these two territories, or these two choke points, with ground-to-air or ground-to-sea missiles, targeted missiles that can attack ships through here. And so they are readying themselves for a push against the world, and they can do that by really impacting shipping through these areas. But in that prophecy, it's not the United States that Iran is pushing against, it's pushing at a European force. And this is just a really interesting facet of looking at this, because the United States and Donald Trump, going back to January 8th, just after he killed Qasem Soleimani, he said, "I call on NATO. This is a warning for NATO," which, you know, America, the European nations, the only other members of NATO really that are involved there. "We want you to take over this job. We want you to replace us here in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East." And NATO has, and the European forces have, started their mission in these same waters that the US is now getting harassed by Iranian boats in the Persian Gulf. And President Trump doesn't forget these statements that he gives. "I gave you on January 8th the warning that we are getting out of here at some point. And maybe if Iran continues to harass the United States, maybe they will. Maybe they will actually decide, okay, now it's your turn, Europe." And then the European forces, of course, there. And European forces then would be the ones that are being harassed by these Iranian forces, which does bring to light that prophecy where Iran pushes at Europe, doesn't push at the United States, it pushes at Europe. So the United States is on the way out, as we go through and we talk about often, and Europe will stay there at least for a while. And that's what, you know, why we draw attention to these type of stories, because Bible prophecy seems to be moving in that direction with these attacks.
Well, we have an article that should be going up on the website soon by Warren Reinch, "Iranian Vessels Harass U.S. Warships in the Persian Gulf." We'll point to that on our show notes, and also an article by Gerald Flurry, Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East. He specifically describes how Iran's strategy for controlling that particular segment of the world, why it's doing that, and how. So do check those articles out, and thank you very much for that, Brent. Well, we haven't heard much about the migrant crisis in Europe recently. Amid all the coronavirus lockdowns, the influx of migrants really did slow down. But evidence is emerging that there is a new migrant wave coming. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, Greece appealed to NATO this week for help in defending its borders. It says that it has satellite imagery showing that Turkey is basically getting ready to shunt another wave of migrants from Turkey on into Greece. They say that they can see a mass movement of refugees from inland deportation centers in Turkey towards the coast of the region, towards some of the coastal areas that are typically used to ferry people from Turkey into some of the Greek islands that aren't that far away. Some of these reports of what Turkey is doing indicate they could be getting ready to release tens of thousands of migrants. Greek authorities have already stepped up their coast guards, their patrols to try and get ready for this. So, you know, if you think back to before the lockdown hit, we had Turkey sending a wave of migrants towards Europe, and they were saying, well, look, Europe, we want you to help with our problems. We want you to help with the problems that have been caused by all of the hundreds of thousands, even I think a couple of million of migrants that Turkey had within its own borders. And they were saying, well, it's not enough just to hand us money. We want Europe, we want you, Germany, we want you to get more involved in Syria. We want you to go and to set up a safe zone in Syria, or you know, deal with some of the problems in Syria so we're not constantly inundated with migrants. Europe didn't really respond to that beyond offering more money and Turkey saying, no, we want more than that. You had the coronavirus hit, and because a lot of this is kind of about public blackmail, it calmed down a bit. But now that some things are starting to open up a little bit, or now that enough time has gone by, you're starting to see this story come up again. I think there's also just the angle of, is the coronavirus going to make the migrant crisis worse? You've also now seeing some statistics coming out of migrant camps in Europe for migrants that are already there, where, you know, if you think about a lot of people crammed in not very sanitary conditions, you've got some conditions that the coronavirus can spread in very, very easily. And is some of that weighing on Turkey's mind right now? Are they having corona problems in their own migrant camps? Is this a way to deal with that? Is almost this threat of kind of biological war? We're sending a whole load of migrants, some of which might be sick. Is that kind of upping the ante there? And you can certainly see how this having corona in the mix can help make this migrant crisis worse as well.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that if it actually turned out that the migrants that Turkey was sending into Europe were infected with coronavirus, and that it, considering the catastrophic damage that coronavirus has done economically to all of Europe, that would the amount of anger that you would have among Europeans that's already roiling over a period of years, that would be reach just explosive levels, wouldn't it?
It would. And then there's the point that we brought up last week, that just a lot of Europeans are struggling right now. A lot of the areas in southern Europe, like southern Italy, that are worst hit by the migrant crisis are also the ones that have been worst hit, at least economically, by the coronavirus. So people's tolerance for government spending money looking after migrants is going to be much, much lower if they feel that their government isn't doing enough to look after them. So you've definitely got this potential for this to just get this migrant crisis to just get worse within Europe moving forwards.
Could you just give a summary of why the migrant crisis that we've seen really unfolding over a period of years is so relevant, prophetically speaking?
Absolutely. I think there's a couple of different very important angles here. One is the one that we've been talking about a few times on this show, that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry gave his Key of David about last week, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. And that's just this idea that the Bible forecasts some very big changes for Europe. You can look at what the Bible says, and it has some very specific prophecies about a European power being not democratic, being autocratic, having strong men, having kings. And Herbert W. Armstrong was forecasting this type of a European Union decades and decades ago. So Europe's got to change. It's going to take something big, some kind of crisis to make that happen. It's going to shrink down to 10 nations. And you can see that the migrant crisis could absolutely play a role in that. And it already is playing a role in that. You see in Italy, just about the number one politician right now, Matteo Salvini, a very much strongman leader who models himself in a few different ways after Mussolini. And he's risen to prominence almost entirely on the back of the migrant crisis. So there's that angle. And then on the other hand, there's a lot of other very important prophecies that talk about Europe getting more involved within the Middle East, specifically even creating an alliance with Syria. And you look at, well, what is Turkey trying to blackmail Europe into doing with the migrant crisis? They're trying to blackmail Europe into getting more involved in the Middle East, specifically in regards to Syria. So you can see how even just the direct action and pressure that Turkey is pushing on Europe, and then the more general pressure of events in the Middle East are creating millions of migrants that are coming into our countries. That's pushing Europe to get more involved in the Middle East, another important trend that we've been watching. And a good place to learn more about that is we have a trends article. I think Brent wrote it in our trends section on Europe and Iran on course for a clash of civilizations that goes through some of the forecasts about Europe getting involved in the Middle East. So this whole big picture of Bible prophecy, you can see tie, as far as Europe is concerned, tying into what we're seeing with the migrants right now.
All right. Well, we will definitely link to that trend article, Europe and Iran on a Course for Clash of Civilizations, and also that Key of David program, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire, very important trend that Gerald Fleury is talking about on that Key of David program. Thank you for that, Richard. To this point, the global protest movements that had dominated the headlines for months have remained quiet while the world has been on lockdown. But in some places in the United States, protests are beginning to emerge over the lockdown itself. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, they've had thousands of people this week across the United States, actually, in many different cities protesting against the lockdowns. But the biggest and most high profile of these protests was in Lansing, Michigan. The Michigan lockdowns were among some of the most draconian, with the governor there signing a stay home, stay safe executive order that shut down all non-critical businesses, told their employees to stay home, mandated that everyone stay 6 feet away from each other. And this lockdown, it pushed about a million Michiganders onto the unemployment rolls and started a recession. I don't think the nation's we don't know yet if the nation's going to go into recession over these lockdowns, but it looks like Michigan definitely is. They're projecting it'll take a couple quarters to get over this. And so that's it's upset quite a few people. And so the Michigan Conservative Coalition put together what they called Operation Gridlock, a way to kind of force the government to lift these lockdowns by having, I think probably around 4,000 people they had show up, just all in their cars, making a gridlock around the Capitol building, just a circular traffic jam. That no one gets in, no one gets out for the whole afternoon of March 15th. And then the Operation Gridlock was supposed to just be the cars, but then obviously you're planning a protest, word gets out, and they had several other groups show up as well, including the Michigan militia. So you saw like people with assault rifles and things like that, like patrolling the sidewalks. And then interviews said that they were there to make sure that things stayed peaceful. But it is, on the one hand, it's definitely It's a little refreshing to see some of the people pushing back some of these pushing back against lockdowns that most constitutional experts have already declared are illegal. Mm-hmm. Instead of just kind of like lying down and letting the rule of law be violated. On the other hand, it is a little jarring in a first world country like the United States to see a state capital surrounded by people in camo pants and machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
Just patrolling through it. It's really it highlights how high the tensions are.
Yeah, it seems like the main story for so much of the lockdown has been just how compliant people have been, how much people have gone along with that, and they've abided by the rules that have been imposed, whether they're legal or not, and the stripping major freedoms and rights from citizens. There's just been a whole lot of a willingness to acquiesce to that. In some ways, it's kind of amazing that you haven't seen more of this kind of behavior, particularly in a nation like the United States. But how long is that going to hold out? You could see, especially as the president begins to unveil, you know, a plan for opening the country up, whether it's, you know, even if it's just doing it in one segment at a time, that if there are individual states or governors, if there are cities that say we're not going to abide by that, that there would be a fair number of people who would really have a tough time with that.
Yeah, it could be. I guess, well, the other statistic that's interesting is actually gun sales have tripled since the coronavirus started. So, I mean, you've got...
It's amazing how many different events have caused gun sales to triple over the last year.
It doesn't take like anything. I don't know.
There's a lot of guns out there.
But it does show that there are even a lot of these people who have been very compliant with the government rules. There is an underlying sense of unease,
yeah,
over all this. And then in this case, like in Lansing, you had some of those people who bought some guns, decided to strap them over your shoulder and head out to the state capital to protest. But it really reveals just how low levels of trust in the government are. And that's primarily the government's fault for enacting a bunch of unconstitutional legislation. But when a nation gets to that point where trust in government institutions is that low, it is dangerous, because then you'll get people, if you don't trust your military and your local police officers and your government officials, well, then you start stockpiling food and guns to make sure that you can take care of your own. The government sees that too, and I wrote an article a few weeks ago about just the number of like propane cannons and remote control helicopters that the U.S. Animal and Plant Inspection Service is stockpiling, because they realize that there are a lot of guns out there, and they're like, well, you've kind of got this arm race between government and the citizens as neither trust the other. And it is just it's piling tinder on a fire that if there's ever a spark big enough to set it off, would be bad. And we can put it in the show notes, Mr. Fleury's article, America's Coming Civil War, that goes through a number of prophecies in Amos 7. And I'm not sure if that article mentions Ezekiel 5 and Isaiah 1, but those are other key prophecies he's highlighted in the past about cities burning with fire and civil unrest and rioting and urban warfare in America.
Mm-hmm.
That, like I said, there's nothing that's really set that off yet. But when God decides it's time for that prophecy to be fulfilled, the firepower is definitely in place on all sides.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit more about the possibility of civil war in the United States in the second half of the show today as well. Andrew has written an article, that the article that he mentioned, America Gearing Up for Martial Law, We will link to that as well as that article by Gerald Flory, America's Coming Civil War. Go check out the show notes for the program today. If you just go to the Listen tab under the onthetrumpet.com, you can find the Trumpet Hour and all of that information, all of the literature that we're talking about. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, as governments send many people free money to survive the coronavirus crisis, a prominent advocate for universal basic income, governments just giving people a regular paycheck whether they work or not, has emerged. Stick around to find out who it is. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
As masses of people remain at home rather than going to work, and unemployment reaches unprecedented levels, governments all over the world are scrambling to save their economies from going belly up. Rescue packages have given money to millions of people. Probably the biggest surge in big government and socialist policy in history. Well, some socialists are pretty excited about it. They want to keep this going, including one very prominent religious leader. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Pope Francis on April 12th, which, you know, for Catholics, that's Easter Sunday. He wrote a letter to the World Meeting of Popular Movements calling for a universal basic income. So first of all, you know, this is on Easter Sunday. This is on one of the most important days of the Catholic calendar. He's choosing to publish this letter. It's not just a routine announcement. And he's calling for universal basic income. Universal basic income is basically free money for everybody. The idea is that everybody gets a certain chunk of money each month. There's no kind of having to prove that you're willing and able and looking for work and all of this. It's just, you know, you get a chunk of money. He wrote, well, he talked about how, you know, we need structural changes in the economy. He talked about how the current global economy is an economy of exclusion and inequality. You know, he talked about the current situation, like you mentioned, with the coronavirus and the responses to it causing real financial hardship. And he wrote, this may be the time to consider a universal basic wage, which would acknowledge and dignify the noble essential tasks you carry out, you know, writing to workers. It would ensure and concretely achieve the ideal at once so human and so Christian that no worker of no worker without rights. And this is a, you know, this is a common theme for the Pope. He's talked about, he's had his 2013 letter called The Joy of the Gospel that talks about, called free market capitalist economies naive because they trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power. He called capitalism a new tyranny and a financial system which rules rather than serves. He's got this long history of calling for a new economic system, and we saw some very concrete practical proposals for him on Sunday, which would be a very radical shift for all the global economic systems.
The way that he's criticized, we've been talking about his criticisms of capitalism before and how in some ways it really is aimed at the United States. And, you know, what's interesting is to hear him coming out and saying this right about the time that you actually have more support among Americans for exactly this universal basic income. I never heard of this before until it was probably just a couple of years ago that you started to hear people saying, well, this would really be the humane thing to do. This is really the way to implement, you know, a safety net that's going to ensure that there is no poverty and so on. But this is just exactly the opposite of what the Bible says. To hear the Pope actually advocating that is quite extraordinary, although I don't suppose that Catholics necessarily care too much just how anti-Bible that doctrine is.
Yes, I think that, and just focusing on the news or the prophetic aspect of this, I think there are a couple of things that are important to watch. I mean, like you mentioned, there is a strong anti-American aspect to this, and if you look at the history of the Pope's history of traveling to Mexico, appearing on the Mexican side of the border and criticizing walls and things like that, there has been a strong anti-American influence from the Catholic Church that has had a big impact on the world. Mr. McDonald had his trumpet brief this week. It was on the WHO, but he talked about this global atmosphere of anti-Americanism, this global spirit of anti-Americanism. And I think the Pope has certainly played a major role in that. And also, it ties into what we were talking about in the first half and what we've been talking about before as well with the euro crisis, where Europe has an economic crisis that is driving it apart. And one of the big things that is prophesied, that the Bible talks about in helping bring Europe together, is the Catholic Church. And now we see the Pope pushing an economic plan. And so, is that going to play a role in uniting Europe? Is this plan going to play a role in uniting Europe? Well, certainly the Catholic Church is going to do that and is going to play a major role in bringing about a new world economy centered around Europe. And so I think it really is interesting when we do see the Pope getting involved in the world of finance, because we've talked about the Catholic Church playing that role for years. And another article you could read along those lines, Mr. McDonald has an article from the March 2014 Trumpet print edition, much more than an economic plan, that talks about the Pope's push here. So I think there's a lot that's very interesting that's going on behind some of these statements.
All right, thanks for that, Richard. We do have an article that is online there. As of yesterday, Pope Francis calls for universal basic income. You can find it on thetrumpet.com. We'll also link to that article from March 2014 from Brad McDonald, Much More Than an Economic Plan. Thanks for that very much, Richard. Who is to blame for all of this coronavirus chaos? Well, there are many who believe China needs to accept responsibility, since that was where the virus originated, although some say it's racist to mention that. Others, though, have a very different view as to who the guilty party is. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
There are a number of stories that are coming out of late that are highlighting how different governments and different medias, well, mainly different medias, I would say, in different countries, some governments are blaming the Jewish people for the spread of coronavirus in Turkey. It's been featured a couple of times on television where the Jews are blamed for such things. Somebody, the son of the former prime minister, went to TV and he said this, quote, "The virus serves Zionism's goals to decrease the number of people in the world and prevent it from increasing. Important investigations confirm this." The Palestinians, in their papers, they are saying that this is a threat, or this has been engineered by the United States and the Jews to take down China. Some of the reasonings and rationale for the thought process through this isn't the best, but nevertheless, they come out and they say these things, that the Jews are to blame for some reason. A Jordanian paper, a journalist for the Jordanian, said this: "The virus is surely an outcome of the Jews' concealed hatred for the entire world, and its spread in the U.S. is meant to demonstrate this and serve as a weapon for the contractor Trump in the upcoming election so as to ensure his re-election." That's from Jordan. The Iranians on Press TV, the state broadcaster, said this, quote, "Zionist elements had developed a deadlier-than-usual strain of coronavirus to be used against Iran, because more Iranians are being killed, and so the Jews are at fault." And interestingly enough, the Iranian health minister came out and said that it came from China, and he was lambasted by his government and officials from China as well. And some of those Iranians that yelled at the health minister for saying such a thing called him a spokesman for Benjamin Netanyahu. And so across the world, you might not see it in a lot of Western countries, but a lot of the Arab countries are going out of their way to blame the Jews for this outbreak of coronavirus, which obviously came from China and is obviously affecting Israelis as well. The Palestinian Authority, the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, came out last week, and he was saying that the Jews are purposely wanting Israeli or Arabs to come from the West Bank and continue to work in Israel. It's about 30,000 of them, so that Israelis can infect those 30,000 of them and send them back to the West Bank to then infect the Palestinians. And so it's kind of crazy to think about this, but we are seeing this across the board, an increase in anti-Semitic remarks related to the origin of corona or how it's spreading.
It's remarkable how much this emerges anytime there's a crisis, it seems like the Jews get blamed, and it's something that's been happening throughout history to various degrees. We do have an article up on the website on this subject in particular, Coronavirus Spreads Anti-Semitism, that we will link to. That's from earlier this week. And also, we had an article from Richard Palmer recently in our print edition, The One Minority Society Loves to Hate. The reason why this is such an important trend to watch is there is a real important spiritual reason why the Jews tend to be targeted in times like this. And you see the kind of contorted logic that it requires to blame them for such a crisis as this. That article will explain the reason why that is the case. That's from our September 2019 print edition. Go check that out to understand the real cause behind this trend. Thanks very much for that, Brent. We next have another story about China recognizing the crisis caused by COVID-19 as an opportunity, this in its fellow Asian nation of Sri Lanka. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Sri Lanka is now in its fourth week of aggressive quarantining and government-imposed lockdown over much of the country. They've got heavily enforced curfews and all kinds of other measures along those lines. And these measures have done an impressive job of keeping COVID-19 from overtaking the island. As of yesterday, they only had about 240 cases and just 7 deaths. And now they are, like many nations around the world, they're, you know, hoping that they can begin to ease up on all these containment measures and reopen the country and the economy. But the trouble is, Sri Lanka doesn't have the technical capacity to be able to test enough people to see how far it spread and in what locations it may have spread, so that they can know whether or not it would be wise to start to open back up. And then Sri Lanka not only lacks those tests, they also lack the kinds of numbers of health professionals that would be needed to carry out broad-scale testing. So in early March, they turned to the international community for help, and China very quickly and eagerly stepped up. China has been in Sri Lanka since, I think, right around the middle of March, donating test kits and all kinds of other equipment, and also sending its people there, some of its healthcare professionals who had experience in Wuhan and other parts of China that were, and in many cases still are, fighting this disease. And then on top of that, China wrote a check for $500 million for Sri Lanka to fight the coronavirus. So the U.S. and the EU both came out later on April 9th and pledged to help Sri Lanka. But by that time, China was already deeply entrenched, and the Chinese aid packages were far larger than what the Europeans or Americans offered. And it's been really amazing to me to see how the Sri Lankans are responding to all this. Just the praise that we're seeing out of Sri Lanka for the Chinese Communist Party, especially considering that Sri Lanka has been that textbook case of what we call debt trap diplomacy, mm-hmm. where they invited China in with their Belt and Road Initiative, and then it ended up blowing up in Sri Lanka's face. They ended up transferring one of their main ports over to Chinese control for 99 years in order to pay for these loans. So that was just a national security nightmare that happened to Sri Lanka just a few short years ago. And for quite some time, Sri Lanka was kind of warning the world, beware of China. Look what happened to us. Don't let that happen to you. Don't let them come in with their Belt and Road and their easy money. But now, because of the coronavirus scare and the way China has stepped in to help Sri Lanka out, we're not hearing any more of that. China has really just won a major PR battle there. And so now we're seeing Sri Lanka, I think, more deeply in the Chinese camp than ever.
Well, it's amazing what a few years can make in a virus crisis. Prophetically speaking, why is this important? Where would you send people for more information?
Yeah, well, at one time, the peoples of Britain and America controlled virtually every important oceanic choke point and sea gate on the planet. All kinds of locations, like the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal, Hong Kong, the Cape of Good Hope. The list goes on and on, and the list includes Sri Lanka. It was back in 1795 that Britain seized control of Sri Lanka's port of Trincomalee from the Netherlands. And the U.S. and Britain coming to control all of these choke points and sea gates was actually prophesied in the Bible. Genesis 22:17 said some of the descendants of Abraham would come to control the gates of their enemies. And other passages show that these descendants would specifically be Ephraim and Manasseh, which are modern-day Britain and America. So that prophecy was fulfilled spectacularly with Sri Lanka and dozens of other places that allow control over oceanic trade and sea communication. But then there's another prophecy saying that if the U.S. and the U.K. rejected God, they would lose control over these locations. That's in Deuteronomy 28. And much of that has also been fulfilled since the end of World War II. The U.S. and Britain have lost control over almost all of those locations, including Sri Lanka, in 1957. That's when London relinquished control of the port of Trincomalee to a newly independent Sri Lanka. And so in the years since then, especially just in the last decade or so, Sri Lanka has moved more and more into the Chinese camp. And now, because China is stepping in to help Sri Lanka through the COVID-19 situation, this nation with its vital sea gates is even more beholden to China. So it's another gate that not only has Britain lost control of, but an enemy nation, China, has essentially gained control of. And we have an article written by Andrew and also Mr. Robert Morley. It's called Besieged in Your Gates. And it has a whole section on Sri Lanka specifically and just on the general picture of sea gates and those prophecies.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We will finish with American politics now that the Democrat presidential candidate is pretty well decided. America's last president has decided it's time to get into the ring and make his endorsement. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, for months, people have been Democrats have been asking President Obama to weigh in on the campaign, and he's always held off, saying that he didn't want to get involved too much, at least publicly, in the primary process, but he saw his main role in this election is unifying Democrats against Republicans. Well, now this Tuesday, with all the Democratic candidates except Joe Biden having dropped out, he decided it was time to actually weigh in and gave a 12-minute video lecture or video speech endorsing Joe Biden for president. The actual endorsement for Joe Biden was more or less what you'd expect from a politician endorsing a politician. But then after he got through that, he went in trying to bring the Sanders wing into the party and admitted to the American public that he's like, well, I'm proud of what I accomplished when I was president, but I think the next administration has to be much more left-wing than mine was. And so he's like, he's advocating, says that we need to return to the Paris Agreement, but then incorporate a bunch of like the Green New Deal proposals into it. We would need to return to the Affordable Care Act, but then incorporate a bunch of Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All proposals into that. And just move the entire Democratic Party much further left than it was when he was president. That seems to be his plan to get the Bernie people and the Biden people on the same team. He's like, says, well, if we announce O'Biden as a person, but then have him basically adopt Bernie Sanders' platform, maybe we can make all Democrats happy.
And it seems like Joe Biden's happy to accommodate that.
Yes, I have not heard hardly anything from him. Maybe wisely, he's got the endorsement and then shut up, and maybe we'll hear from him again. And
well, yeah, November, what little I have heard from him, it does seem like he's been much more much further to the left than what he was touted to have been early on in the primaries. It seems like that really has been the big trend throughout the primaries for the Democrats, is the shift to the left.
Yeah, the exit polls definitely indicate that, is that people go to the primary, vote for Biden, and then fill out a questionnaire endorsing all of Bernie's proposals afterwards. So I think the thing that killed Bernie Sanders' campaign is he's a little honest, a little too honest about where those proposals come from. They like the proposals. They just, I guess people just don't like being constantly reminded that they come from socialist, communist ideas. But then the other interesting thing, and this even surprised me a little bit, with this speech Obama gave, was just how militant his rhetoric against Republicans were. He's normally pretty famous for his pious platitudes, where he talks about, like, there's no red America, no blue America, there's only the United States of America, and then it's only in his actions that you create division. But he, one part here where he's talking about, well, this is a quote, he said, "So our country's future hangs in the balance in this election, and it's not will be easy. The other side has a massive war chest. The other side has a massive propaganda network with little regard for the truth." And so this faces of, like, terms like the other side and war chest are definitely have a military tone to that rhetoric that you haven't heard from him as much in the past. But no, but we've already got America's coming civil war in the show notes. And so the prophetic angle for this story is very similar, or basically the same as the prophetic angle for that story about these protests in Michigan, about this just deep division in America with politicians talking about the other side and war chest, even as you've got militia members with actual weapons of war protesting against government orders that violate the Constitution. And it just shows just how high these tensions are, and you can if you read that article, America's Coming Civil War, you could really start to see how a prophecy like the one in Isaiah 1 and verse 7 about cities burning with fire because people are revolting more and more could come to pass.
Yeah, I can't help but think too about just the last Trumpet edition, where Gerald Ford was talking about how America has been fundamentally transformed. That definitely seems like another aspect of this that you can't ignore, is just how much the whole, this half of the country politically has shifted in a fundamental way. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of David Starr Jordan. Wisdom is knowing what to do next. Virtue is doing it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.